It's Wednesday, September 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, Islamic State is one of the main topics discussed by world leaders at the United Nations. Another down day on global markets as Google aims to go up with a new tablet.
It's immigrants and the children of immigrants that are keeping the population growing in the United States.
Immigration to the United States is up. We have the latest numbers. Also ahead, you can own a piece of Hollywood, or at least a part of it. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States on Tuesday announced a financial sanctions against major Islamic State leaders and financial figures and designated additional individuals and groups as foreign terrorist fighters. The Treasury and State Departments imposed the penalties on a total of 30 individuals and groups in what a senior Obama administration official described as a real ramp-up by the U.S. to prevent the Islamic State group from exploiting the global financial system. This is believed to be the most ambitious U.S. attempt to undercut the Islamic State group's financial support. At the 70th session of the United Nations General Assembly, President Barack Obama held a summit for the Anti-Islamic State Coalition. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir joins us with more. Margaret?
That's right. We had the president here today. There were more than 100 countries that joined him at this summit on countering ISIL. And he announced that three more countries have joined the coalition, Nigeria, Tunisia, and Malaysia. So now there are about 65 countries that are working to fight this terrorist group. President Obama said about two dozen countries are contributing to the military campaign, and that there has been some progress in the past year. The Iraqi military, with help from the coalition, has liberated towns in Kirkuk and Tikrit, and so that's a positive sign. And even in Syria, there's new pressure being put on ISIL strongholds in the city of Raqqa.
This particular meeting isn't just isolated. I assume that these are ongoing discussions.
Well, it's sort of a follow-up meeting to last year at UNGA. The president chaired a session in the UN Security Council where a resolution was adopted on stemming the flow of foreign fighters across borders and on trying to halt financing to them. And there was a session, I believe, in February at the White House on terrorism, and then this is sort of a follow-up to both of those events. And it was kind of an assessment meeting where they assessed where the gaps are from last year and what needs to be done still.
Speaking of flows across borders, in a related matter, we have this large migration issue happening in Europe, and I understand that that's going to have some discussion tomorrow at the UN.
Yeah, there's going to be a major meeting that the Secretary General of the United Nations is hosting on the migration and refugee crisis, and it will bring together numerous countries. Today we heard from the Hungarian Foreign Minister, Peter Szijjártó, who spoke to reporters, and he said that Hungary, which has been receiving many migrants and refugees, they are going to propose tomorrow that instead of just European quotas on accepting refugees and migrants, there should be what he was calling world quotas, and that all major international players should accept some of the migrants and refugees. And you may know that his country has been criticized, really, for the way they've treated some of the migrants and refugees who've arrived there in recent months. And they've been criticized also for building walls on their borders with Serbia and Croatia to keep them out, fences, really. But he sort of pushed it aside and said, look, part of being a state is that you protect your borders, and so that's what we're trying to do. So he wouldn't accept the criticism on the fence.
Always interesting discussions and comments made during this annual meeting. Margaret Bashir is our UN correspondent. You get to hear it all. Thanks for joining us, Margaret.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, time now to check out reactions to what we call the CVE Summit. And as always, our G, Abby Lee, is here in the studio to tell us what people are tweeting about it. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What is a good handle to follow today?
Well, a lot of foreign correspondents from different media outlets are live tweeting from the venue. But if you're the type to avoid information overload like I try to, I'll say Andrea Mitchell from NBC News is a good one to follow. She's our chief foreign affairs correspondent, and she sent out this tweet earlier. I caught up with John Kerry on his way to UNGA 2015. Now he is at a summit hosted by POTUS on combating terrorism. She's on Twitter at Mitchell Reports, and may I just add, she's married to the former Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan.
Indeed.
And that has nothing to do with the topic, but I thought I'd just mention it as a fun fact.
Indeed she is. Mm-hmm. So did Secretary Kerry or President Obama tweet about the event?
Well, Mr. Kerry did. He tweeted this earlier. Eliminating ISIL will take time, but as POTUS said, hashtag CVE summit today marked emergence of movement united in degrading, destroying ISIL. CVE stands for Countering Violent Extremism.
Well, I also understand, G, that there's a new Twitter account that's getting an awful lot of attention today, right?
Exactly. And we can't end this segment today without mentioning Edward Snowden joining Twitter sphere. Now, we're going there. We're talking about the NSA whistleblower. He's on Twitter at Snowden, and his account is already verified. Mm. He has more than 606,000 followers as of now, and he has one account he's following. And guess what it is?
Well, that might be one that has been closely following him offline.
Exactly. He's following the official account for the National Security Agency at NSAGOV on Twitter. Jim, I think it's kind of sad, but NSA, which has been around Twitter for much longer, only has about 90,000 followers.
Oh, my goodness. Well, before you go, what was Snowden's first tweet?
The first tweet was sent out around noon EST, and it read, "Can you hear me now? ? That's been retweeted more than 70,000 times already. Jim?
Wow, amazing reach. And thank you for the analysis, G. You, of course, can follow G on Twitter at G Abby Lee. And you can also follow our VOA International Edition account. It's at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. Senate is expected to approve a temporary spending bill that will be keeping the federal government operating until mid-December, and that puts off yet another Republican showdown with President Barack Obama over spending priorities. The expected vote comes after the chamber voted 77-19 on Monday to advance the measure toward a final vote. And once it gets the Senate's approval, it will be sent on to the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, which has until midnight Wednesday to approve the bill. Meanwhile, turmoil continues in global markets with continued concerns about China. Alexis Christophorus follows economic news for VOA and joins us now from our bureau in New York.
Global stock markets reached a two-year low on Tuesday as the outlook for raw material prices and emerging markets remained soft. U.S. biotech shares remained under pressure as well. Asian share markets came under intense selling pressure, with Japan's Nikkei losing over 4% following a steep retreat on Wall Street the prior day. Commodity prices edged up but held near multi-year lows. Concern over an economic slowdown in major raw material consumer China. U.S. stocks closed slightly higher, but it was a choppy session, and an early rally in biotechs faded to deal the sector its eighth straight drop. The S&P 500 managed to barely snap a five-session losing streak, but remained close to August lows that analysts see as a key support level. Jim?
Well, as the markets are going down, Google is hoping to go up with a new tablet, and I also understand, Alexis, that there are some Nexus smartphones coming out.
That's right. Now it's Google's turn to come out with some new products. The launch of the phones, the Nexus 6P and the Nexus 5X, come a day after Apple reported first weekend sales of its new iPhones, and they were at a record. Google said the new version of Android called Marshmallow will roll out to existing Nexus customers beginning next week. The Nexus 5X is made by South Korea's LG Electronics and the Nexus 6P by China's Huawei Technologies. Both phones feature Google's new fingerprint sensor, Nexus Imprint, which is located on the back of the phone, and the phones are available for pre-order on the Google Store. And then, of course, there is the new tablet, the Pixel C tablet. That tablet will be available in time for the holiday shopping season on the Google Store as well. Jim?
Well, perhaps on our list as well, and maybe a new way to contact each other as we get business news daily from Alexis Christophers in New York. Alexis, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Jim.
It's been 50 years after a landmark immigration legislation was enacted into law in the United States, and now a new study by the Washington-based Pew Research Center says nearly 59 million immigrants have arrived here, pushing to nearly 14% the number of people who are foreign-born. It says the number of immigrants who arrived in the United States between 1965 and 2015 exceeded the flood of arrivals of mostly European immigrants during the 19th and early 20th centuries. And while attention has been focused on immigrants entering the country from Latin America, the Pew Research study finds that the flow has slowed in recent years, and the percentage of Hispanics in the United States will actually decline by 31% by the year 2065. Meanwhile, it projects that Asian immigrants will make up 38% of the foreign-born population by that year and will be the largest immigrant group by 2055. Mike Mather, the Washington-based Population Reference Bureau, told VOA's Victor Beatty, if current demographic trends continue, future immigrants and their descendants will be an even bigger source of growth, accounting for most of the population increase, more than 100 million, as the United States population grows to 441 million by 2065.
It's immigrants and the children of immigrants that are keeping the population growing in the United States. It's keeping our population relatively young compared to what's happening in parts of Europe and Japan and some other countries that don't have high levels of immigration and don't have relatively high birth rates. So it's having a significant impact on population growth, and it's changing the racial ethnic makeup in this country.
There are mixed views, according to this study, among Americans who have been here for a generation or more about this flood of immigration. The U.S. has long been known as a nation of immigrants. I think this study indicates that one in five are foreign-born today in this country. To what do you attribute the mixed view among Americans who have been here a while, and what impact might this have on politics?
I think that part of it has to do with, you know, when the economy is running smoothly and the unemployment rate is low, we tend to have more positive views about immigration. We obviously just got over a bad economic patch, and I think so the recession may have played some role in people's negative views about people coming in and potentially taking people's jobs. But you also have to consider that back in the early 1900s, people were very much against many immigrants coming in from Europe. Today, many people oppose high levels of immigration from Latin America. But people's views change over time, and I expect that over time people will change their views about immigration from Latin America just as they have about immigrants from Europe.
Well, 50 years on after this landmark immigration law was passed in 1965, do you think any of the authors had any idea what this would portend?
No, I would say that they probably had no idea that they had opened the gates, so to speak, to the number of immigrants and their children that are currently here in the United States. So there are certainly some unintended consequences, I think, related to that legislation. It's obviously accounted for most of our growth for the past 50 years.
One of the most interesting findings in this Pew Research study was not so much that Hispanics were making a larger part of the population. It's the Asian immigrants that are projected to make up the larger share of all immigrants in the next 50 years.
Yeah, and I will say that it's difficult to project 50 years out into the future what's going to occur. A lot of that is driven by immigration policy. It's driven by what happens not only with the economy in the United States, but what's happening with the economy in those sending countries. So it's hard to predict, but if current trends continue it's true that Asians will make up the majority of the foreign-born population maybe by mid-century.
Is this a somewhat of a quiet revolution? Not too many people are talking about it.
No, I don't think they are. And to be honest, I think people pay much more attention to immigrants from Latin America who are much more likely to have less education. Many may not have graduated from high school. And so there's more attention paid to immigrants who many feel are taking benefits that should be going to U.S.-born citizens and so on.
Mather says most of the Asian immigrants coming to the United States are from the region's two largest countries, China and India, with large pools of high-skilled workers and students. From 1965 to the present, the number of Hispanics more than quadrupled from 4% to 18%. Asians saw their share rise from less than 1% in 1965 to 6% this year. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
If you ever wanted to own a piece of Hollywood history, this week you have your chance. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, some prized artifacts from Star Wars, Star Trek, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and even an actual Academy Award are up for bid in Hollywood.
If you've ever wanted to own a part of movie history, you can bid this week at Profiles in History in Calabasa, California. Items from some of Hollywood's biggest blockbusters, including the original 1977 version of Star Wars, are up for bid. Brian Chanis is the head of acquisition for the auction house.
We have your usual suspects, things coming ranging from Star Wars, Star Trek, Jaws. We have Quint's harpoon rifle from Jaws. One of the iconic barrels, his machete, and just things from all over movie history that people clamor towards.
Brian Chanis says other items up for sale include the golden slave bikini Carrie Fisher wore when she was a captive of Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi, and her ship from the original Star Wars in 1977 is also on the block.
One of my favorite pieces actually came from Grant McCune, who won the Academy Award for visual effects in Star Wars. It's the very first spacecraft that you see in the opening sequence of the first Star Wars. And that one, we have an estimate of $200,000 to $300,000, but I suspect that it's going to be, you know, more in the maybe $500,000 range plus.
Indiana Jones's fedora and bullwhip and a motorcycle ridden by Daredevil Evel Knievel will also be sold. Brian Chanis says that Star Trek fans will have the chance to bid on original costumes worn by the late Leonard Nimoy as Spock in both the television show and in the Star Trek movies.
Original series, second season tunic, the velour one with all the braid, the insignia from Star Trek, the original series, great documentation. We also have a costume of his from Star Trek, the motion picture back in 1979 when he started doing the feature films. Then, of course, we also have his costume when he mind-melded with the humpback whale in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. So, you know, we have things, you know, covering his earlier years as Spock and also his later years.
Nimoy died February 27th at age 83. And if you've ever wanted your very own Academy Award, Brian Chanis says you have the chance to own a very rare one.
Only the third best actress Oscar ever presented. It was for Norma Shearer for the film The Divorcee from 1930. And, you know, rarely do you see an Oscar of that caliber reach the auction block. It's one of the very first that was presented. It's got the Belgian marble base. They look a little bit different than the cylindrical bases of today's. But that one we have at $150,000 to $250,000.
Other items in the catalog include Russell Crowe's costume as Maximus in Gladiator, Angelina Jolie's custom wetsuit and gun rig from Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life, and a complete Spartan costume, including helmet, shield, and leather girdle from The 300. Or you could bid on a full Spider-Man costume from Spider-Man 3. Music fans can bid on John Lennon's British Fireman's Coat, a Gibson Firebird guitar played and signed by Carlos Santana, or an authentic amulet charm made with Jimi Hendrix's hair. The auction runs through October 1st. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
I know what our director, Tracy Carter, will be bidding on. Sorry you had to fade out Jimi Hendrix there. We could have let that go. You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. We greatly appreciate you for joining us, and we greatly appreciate our engineer, too, Carl Starling. Thank you, Carl. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The basin of the lower Mekong River, which runs from China through Burma, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, and drains into the South China Sea, is home to over 60 million people. Some 85% of them rely directly on the river for their livelihoods, particularly those who are involved in irrigated agriculture and fishing. This means that any unexpected occurrence that affects the flow of the Mekong River could spell disaster for the entire region. That is why, on August 31st, USAID and NASA, in cooperation with the Asian Disaster Preparedness Center, the Deltares Institute of the Netherlands, Sweden's Stockholm Environment Institute, and the Spatial Informatics Group of California, launched the Surveyor Mekong Project, which will use satellite imagery to monitor the region's environment. The hope is that this technology will allow for more accurate prediction and management of floods, droughts, and other natural disasters, allowing regional decision makers to improve agricultural risk management, manage land use more sustainably, assess impacts of hydroelectric power facilities, and help governments and communities increase resilience to the negative effects of climate change. So, for example, satellite imaging will monitor weather patterns, water cycles, and water availability, which may be heavily impacted by climate change and by population growth. This will allow for better long-term planning, which should improve regional food security and forest resource management. On the other hand, a function called satellite remote sensing can monitor long-term changes in vegetative land cover caused by urbanization, deforestation, and agricultural practices. This data could, for example, be used to determine whether current farming practices are producing optimal crop yields. Such information will allow agronomists, urban planners, natural resource managers, and forestry personnel to make informed decisions about crops, urban development, and forest management, to name just a few. Under Surveyor Mekong, we are tapping into the best available science and technology to help protect this region's vital ecosystems and the benefits they provide to society, said Beth Page, director of USAID's Regional Development Mission for Asia. Already, Asian scientists, NASA scientists, and others are beginning to develop tools to build resilience and contribute to tackling some of the region's most pressing challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.